Okay, so we are doing audio recording as per usual, and the deck, the audio recording, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website sometime, probably later on this evening. And I'm now going to mute all. And as per usual, you have the ability to unmute yourself if you choose to do so for a question or comment. Please remute yourself afterwards so we'll keep noise in the background down to a minimum. So with that, I will stop the share and kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Susie can find the unmute button. There we go. okay, I just a question just came into the suggestion box, but for some reason it doesn't want me to paste it into the chat window. So I'll have to deal with that later, or next week maybe even. Okay, so I think we have the slide up, or do we? Did I share my screen?
Not yet.
Well, let's try and do that first then. There we go.
Now we got it.
Okay. All right, so if I can find a way to drive it, off to the races. Okay, well, good evening, everyone. We do have a whole bunch of stuff, again, a mixed bag anyway. So let's start off with a question that came in about smartphones and how to send and receive mail on the phone. And basically, I think there are just two options. You can use webmail, which you need the phone's browser. And if you do that, it's basically just like using your computer or your tablet, and it's essentially the same interface. However, the other alternative is to use an email client. And I use Thunderbird on my PC, and Thunderbird is cross-platform. So it runs on Linux, and it also runs on Windows when I use that side of my dual boot system. And my problem is that on Android, there is no Thunderbird version. So I use a different email client, and the one I use is called K9 Mail. And the nice thing about K9 is it's similar to Thunderbird in terms of it allows you to have multiple accounts, so that's actually useful because I have a personal account and I have an OPCUG account, and I can keep track of both of those. It supports IMAP, which I use for all my systems. It also supports POP3 if you use that. It allows you to create custom folders in IMAP, so that's actually quite handy for me. It has, by default, it has a unified inbox. So it basically puts all of the mail that you receive into a common inbox. And personally, I don't like that. So I actually disable that feature. The good news is it's free and it's also open source. And more than 5 million people have downloaded it. So it's probably fairly popular. And the good news about that is that there's quite an active user forum. So if you don't know how to do something, and typically with Android systems, documentation is rather poor, if you search for how to do it in K9, you'll generally find an answer in the user forums or on the web somewhere. So the interface, it basically comes up in your default email system, and you can see here, here are the different folders. But you also notice that in addition to my red OPCUG account, I also have a blue account, a second account. And if I just click on that little icon, then it brings up the folders or the inbox for the second account. So it's actually quite easy to maintain two different accounts. If you click on the inbox, or you have it come up by default, then the interface is as shown on the right. You basically get a list of the various messages with the subject line, who's sending it, the sender, and a couple of lines of text so you can see whether you want to address it immediately or not. If you select any particular message, let's take this one from Micheline, then you get the standard header and the body text. But notice also that you have this double arrow type thing here. If you click on that, as you might think, that's the reply or reply all, or you can also forward the message to other people. And then on top here, you have a back button so you can go back to the inbox. You can delete, you can copy this message or move it to some other area. And you have a previous message and next message. And you have some more options here. So it's quite a standard kind of messaging interface and pretty easy to navigate, I think. I noticed Chris had just put a note in the chat window that Paul Thoreau's website indicated this week that Mozilla have acquired the developer of K9, Christian Ketterer, and he's going to be working to transform K9 into an Android app, and it's going to be called Thunderbird on Android. So I'm actually quite looking forward to that, because then presumably if he makes it look a lot like the PC version of Android, I'm going to have a version of Thunderbird that I can use on all three of my operating systems. So that will be quite good.
It was actually Tristan who posted in about the announcement. He gave the link to TechSpot where it was announced. So I just pasted in the Thoreau.com link that you see on the screen right there now. So yeah, if you're interested in those, check out those links both from Tristan as well as the one at Thoreau.com.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And it's TBD. There's no release date in sight yet. Apparently, that's there's right. Quite a bit of work to do to make K9 kind of much more compatible with Thunderbird. So we'll see how it all works out. Okay, our next thing is Chris has an interesting item, which is a follow-up on that zero-day vulnerability.
Yeah, this was a bit of an ugly one. It allowed basically remote code execution just by viewing a Word document. Didn't even have to be a Word document. If you previewed in Windows an RTF document, it could actually exploit it as well. So went into some detail on it at the June 1st Q&A. Apparently it has been fixed. And interestingly, Naked Security's blog from Sophos, they reported it as being fixed in the June monthly update. But curiously, Microsoft didn't list it as in the list of fixes that came out this month. But Sophos did check, and sure enough, if you apply the monthly updates to a computer, the exploit no longer works. So that's good news.
So any idea, Chris, what happens for those of us who patch the registry?
I do not know, because they didn't talk about it in the Sophos article about whether they go and put the registry key back in place. I think most people would never even notice if they put the fix in that removed that registry key. It's not going to do anything bad for you. Nobody needed that outside of possibly a corporate environment. And even there, most corporate environments wouldn't need it either. So if you applied the fix, I wouldn't worry about it. You could put the key back. If you made the option to back up the registry key, you could reinstall it, but you don't have to. I don't think there's any negative impact to it.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I patched my registry, and at both times I've used Windows since, nothing bad happens. So it must be good. Okay, next we have a share, and this is from Bill Bradwin, and he's basically recommending an app called Google Keep, which is essentially a note-taking app. It allows you to make notes and also various kinds of lists. As you can see on the phone here, you can use color to highlight individual notes. And you're also allowed to add various labels and photographs and so forth. It also lets you use the microphone to actually create the note using voice activation. And it, because it's Google, it will actually save a transcribed version of that audio recording. And also because it's, the other thing you can do is you can share notes with people and work in kind of collaboration on various tasks. And the other thing, because it's Google, is it has a search engine and you can find stuff and it says you can do it very quickly. And the good news is, if you're interested in this app, you can use it on a phone, you can use it on a tablet, and you can also use it on your computer. And I actually tried it out quickly, and here's the PC version. Basically, it's using my Google account, and it's a web-based system. So here you can see I've created a note that there's going to be a Q&A, so I've got a nice image. Q&A is on Wednesday, June 15th at 7:30. And I also set a reminder, so presumably it would tell me at 7:20 that I should log on to the Q&A and meet with you all. I don't use Google Keep, so I didn't actually try that. If you click on this little bar here on the take a note, then it lets you add a note as pure text. But it also gives you the options to add things like images and reminders and change the background and so forth. And then the other options are things like create a list, like the one we saw on the phone, create a note and then add a drawing, freehand type drawing, or call up an image from your gallery and add that to the note, for example, as I did with the Q&A note here. And here's an example of a note which is set up as a list. And you notice it says input wanted for future Q&A sessions. And we're open to questions and shares. We have a section on computer basics, on smartphone basics. And you've just seen a smartphone basics item. And we also have questions to do with Windows and Linux and Android. And we're even just looking for ideas for topics. Does this sound like an advert? So anybody out there want to check off any one of these items? All you have to do is send us a note made up in Google Keep and send it to suggestion box at opcug.ca. And we will slot you into next week's Q&A session. All right, that's the our sponsor. So here's my list. And notice down here on the bar, I've got this background options icon. If I click on that, I can change the background to a simple color, bright yellow, let's say. Or I can choose an image from any of these predefined images. And you can see here I've taken this kind of pencil icon, because this is a list and you're supposed to check things off. So you get a nice shiny image and quite a nice looking note. So if you like that kind of stuff, Google Keep looks like a neat kind of app. What Bill sent me was a link, and the link was to a YouTube video, and it's on Dottotech. And if anybody remembers Steve Dotto, he used to have a computer program on television, probably in the 90s, where he would talk about apps and operating systems and all that kind of good stuff. He looks a little bit different these days, but he maintains a YouTube channel, and there's all kinds of interesting stuff on there if you want to take a look. So Dottotech on YouTube. Anything in the chat, Chris?
There was just a comment from Tom. He likes our shopping our shopping list for grocery shopping. And Lawrence mentioned that the Google Keep will actually work if you have a Samsung Galaxy 4 Wear 3 smartwatch. He says it's cool to tap off the grocery list from your watch. So that's kind of a neat idea. Yeah, if you're out shopping, just be able to go through your grocery list right on your watch.
I notice Lawrence is just noting another cool aspect while shopping. The better half can add items while you're out and about. Not sure why that's so good, actually. You could spend your life in the shopping aisles. Okay, thanks, everyone. And thanks to Bill for that share. Okay, next item is another follow-up from Chris.
Did I actually have this? Okay. So when we were talking last about, and this was again June 1st, Q&A, Wi-Fi versus mobile network for using your Android phone, which is safer? And at the time, I really thought that Android by itself is quite safe, and you don't have a big requirement for things that you do on your desktop, things like antivirus and firewalls. A lot of people will argue against that, and there are firewalls available and there's antivirus available for Android if you want that additional safety factor there. At the Q&A, nobody else voiced any opinions against that, but Tom did come up afterwards with an interesting website that he posted to the member forum on June 3rd. So next. So the URL is there. I will paste it into the chat as well. And some of the highlights of the article, the quotes out of it are there. You can read at your leisure. But basically it comes down to the fact that the author didn't think that there was a really big threat on Android. Certainly not as big as some people would make it out to be. But that there are some apps that can help you out with, in particular, some things about security and privacy issues. And so how much information can be leaking out about your usage of your Android phone. So there's 14 apps that are there. I highly encourage anybody to take a look at them. None of them, I think, are real showstoppers that you really absolutely, you know, it's not something I would recommend that everybody go out and install all of these apps, but take a look at it. And if you have a sensitivity about any particular one of those, there's some free apps that you can install there that might help you out. So thanks to Tom for posting that to the member forum.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And moving along, another smartphone basics item. This is basically an article that showed up in PC Magazine a day or so ago. I don't think there's anything new here, but it's kind of positive reinforcement, I guess, if you're concerned about charging your phone, and especially charging your phone overnight. So there are links there if you want to actually read the article. It's quite long. There's lots of different stuff in it. But the kind of highlights, as far as I'm concerned, they basically say that if you charge your phone overnight, you're not going to overload the battery. There's hardware built into the phone that makes sure that the phone cannot overcharge. And basically what happens is it's a lithium ion battery typically, and it charges until it gets to 100% capacity, and then the software basically turns the charging off. And then the phone starts to discharge because its circuitry is taking some current. And if the voltage drops to, or the charge drops to 99%, then the charger kicks in again with a trickle charge. And when you wake up in the morning, it's quite likely that you'll have 100% battery capacity. Now, one of the things they do note is, though, that when you're charging your phone, it does generate heat. So one of the things they say is, don't put the phone underneath your pillow and charge it, because that will trap all the heat in the phone and probably cause the phone to overheat, and that could cause some problems. So place the phone in the open as much as possible. They actually suggest that maybe you should think about taking out of the case if you have one, unless it's super difficult, in which case just make sure there's good air circulation around the phone. And if you're really concerned about potential fires, then you could always place it in a fireproof dish or some kind of ceramic saucer, for example, so that it can't burn the house down, or hopefully it won't burn the house down. Now, they talk about cables and using cheap cables, which may not do the job. So they really recommend using the cable that came with the phone charger, the original cable, or at least a certified replacement that has some quality to it. Now, they talk about charging and discharging, and as I think everybody knows, they recommend that you should charge it when it's partially discharged. Maybe when it gets to like 30 or 40%, you might want to recharge it. And if you can, you should probably think about charging it to less than full capacity, maybe around 80%. And they recommend a range of like 30 to 80% where you might want to maintain your phone to get optimal performance and battery life, essentially. One of the things they note is that people think about batteries developing a memory, but that was only true for nickel cadmium batteries. And these days, phones are typically using lithium ion, and lithium ion does not develop a memory. However, they will deteriorate, and you won't get full charge after a certain period. But it's essentially based on the number of times that the phone gets discharged and recharged, the so-called charge cycles. So, again, I don't think that's anything new to anybody, but if you've been doing some of those things, then PC Magazine recommends that you keep doing those things.
I have a question, actually, about charging and that. And just as an example, my Google Pixel comes with a, you buy extra, a 30-watt charger. Now, I know you can charge it with, you know, something that will put out a lot less than 30 watts, and it'll just be slower. But I've always heard that you're actually safe to use a higher wattage charger than the device came with or the battery came with, and that the batteries themselves can deal with the fact that, you know, the charger can put out an awful lot more. So I have a laptop computer right here that has I think it's a 50 watt charger, and it's USB-C. So I would like to be assured that I can charge my Pixel phone, which was designed to go with a 30 watt charger, using a 50 watt charger without any danger or problem. So I'm just wondering if anybody has any confirming information on whether that is okay to do, or whether you should really stick with the maximum wattage charger that the device actually came with.
Yeah, Tom just posted in the chat that the Pixel 6 is limited to 23 watts, and the 6 Pro to a 27 watt charging rate.
Yeah, but the thing is, I'm wondering if you can actually use a 50 watt charger, and it will just happily use 23 watts or 27 watts, and there's no danger involved in damaging the battery or anything like that.
Well, I would imagine that's what it means by limited. The hardware must be limiting it to a certain power input. Sorry, Tom, are you trying to comment there?
Yes, I am. I have a Pixel 6, and I looked into it. And you can charge it at 23 watts if you use a Google charger, or 27 for the 6 Pro. For other chargers, I use I have a 65 watt, I think it's Anker, USB-C charger, and it only charges at about 15 watts. And most other, I believe that. Google limits Pixel phones to charging at 15 watts, no matter what other charger you use, unless you use a Pixel stand.
Oh, okay.
Or a Pixel charger.
Okay. So in other words, I would actually be further ahead using my, like I did buy the Google Pixel charger, which is a 30 watt charger. I have the plain Pixel 6, so presumably it would actually charge at 23 watts, whereas if I plug in my laptop power adapter, I'm only going to be charging at 15, is what you're saying.
Yes, you can get these things that will actually measure the charging rate.
Oh, okay.
For USB, we'll have the USB A, USB C, and in fact, micro as well.
Cool.
That you can use in line with the charging cable. But you can also use a program such as AccuBattery, which I use, that actually shows you the charging rate as it charges.
Ah.
And usually it runs with my 65-watt thing. It runs at about 2,300 milliamps, which is about 5 times 10. It's about a little over 12 watts or something like that.
Okay.
But you will see, I suggest using AccuCharging because it will also alert you when it reaches a particular charge point, and it says, it guides you as to what is the, will give you the longest lifetime for your battery in terms of years.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's good. At least I know that I'm not going to damage the battery. I may be able to optimize it a little bit better, but at least I'm not going to hurt things. So that's good. Well, thanks, Tom.
It's always best to keep your any lithium battery device, you're best to keep it ideally between 40 and 60%. If you need it for a longer time, then 20 to 80 is pretty good. It will prolong the life of your battery if you keep it in those ranges, so that you can, because batteries are so hard to change in devices. One interesting thing, I have an Oculus Quest 2, the headset thing for 3D VR. And I found that it was curious. It charges by USB-C, and I was using my charging measure thing on it. And it was charging for at 5 volts and about 2 amps for a long time. And then as it got towards the end, it switched up to 9 volts and 1 amp. So it was using towards the very end of the charging cycle around, I don't know, I saw it at 95%, but it probably started around 80. It changed to a higher voltage to push more milliamps into the battery. This is curious. I haven't seen that before.
Interesting.
Because USB-C can charge at anywhere between 5 volts and 20 volts, depending on the device you're charging and what it will accept. It negotiates what the charge rate will be.
Okay, thanks Tom and Chris. And our next item is Bob Walker in his series of video on audio tools. He's going to be talking about ripping CDs. So over to you, Bob.
I'm going to turn off my webcam here to preserve some of my bandwidth here, the joys of rural high speed. And let me just share the screen.
Oops.
And here we go. Okay. So far we covered several topics in this series. And tonight we're going to cover how to rip your CDs to MP3s using Express Rip CD Ripper. Okay. For many of us, our music collections represent the soundtracks of our lives. And hearing particular songs can take us back to those special places and times and those special people. And so we don't want to lose any of this music, as all the media formats keep changing. So tonight we're going to look at how to turn your music on CDs to MP3s. And near the end, we'll also take a quick look at vinyl records and cassettes as well. Okay, so what do you do with your CDs? Some of us have a lot of CDs we've accumulated over time. What can we do with them now? Most new cars, computers, and everything else no longer come with a CD player. everything now, including car infotainment systems, smartphones, computers, smart TVs. It's all geared towards MP3s and similar electronic formats. Even new CD players, if you can actually find one, usually also have a USB port for playing MP3s. So tonight we're going to show you how to what you can do with your CDs. The software I'm going to be showing is from NCH. It's their Express Rip CD ripping software. And this software lets you extract digital audio tracks directly from audio CDs, which normally use the CDA file format, to MP3s or WAV or many other audio formats. Express Rip can also save track information or tags to MP3 files, including the title, the artist, the album name, and other custom metadata information. It can automatically link to online databases to obtain this tag information if it's not available on the CD. It can also correct or adjust the audio volume level of the ripped tracks as they are extracted, and a whole lot more. We're just going to cover the basics here tonight. Because the RIP takes digital CD files and turns them into digital MP3s, there's none of the loss of quality you get when you're copying and transferring analog information. One of the things you're going to need is a computer with a CD player or some sort of external, like a USB CD player that you can plug into your computer. A lot of the internal and external drives also include DVD and Blu-ray functionality as well. And many of these can also record or burn as well as play. The prices for these external drives starts around $25 and goes up from there. Okay, we're going to have a look at the user interface here. It's fairly simple, basic interface, easy to understand. The options button, which is number one, this brings up the options screen. The second point is that's the output folder window, and you can use the browse button here to set the output folder where you want the files to be stored. There's a drop-down window here for the output format, and the default when you install it is MP3, but there's about 20 other formats you can save to. Number four is the CD-DVD drive selection window. And when you start up Express Rip, the window is usually blank until you plug in the CD drive and put a CD into it. And then you can select the CD drive number. And then number five is the encoder settings, and we'll cover that in just a minute. Okay, on the options screen, when you click on the options button on the main interface, you're going to want to use all the default options to start. Once you get used to using the program, you can start to play around with them. The one thing you might want to change is the file name format for the extracted files. The default or the first option puts the output files in an output into the output directory you've selected, and it puts them into a subdirectory with the artist name, for example, Phil Collins, and then into a sub-subdirectory with the name of the album, for example, Face Value, and with a file name made up of the track number, you know, 1, 2, 3, or whatever, and the song name. The second option puts the output files directly into the output directory with a file name made up of the artist name, the song name, and each option has its advantages. And we're going to have to look more at this in the next session when I cover how to edit the tags for your MP3s. Okay, the encoder settings. Again, you want to start with the default encoder settings, except you might want to tick off the box there for high quality encoding. This slows down the ripping a little bit, but it gives you a higher quality copy. Okay, so to actually rip a CD, you start up ExpressRip, load a CD into the drive. When you do that, ExpressRip should detect this and list the contents of the drive automatically in the main window. If it doesn't, click on the drive window and select the proper drive. And then once all the tracks are loaded, click on button 2 there, rip the CD. And when you do this, pop-up window number 3 there will show the status of the track ripping. Ripping the CD normally takes 5 to 10 minutes. When the rip is complete, a window will pop up asking if you want to rip another CD or view extracted files in the folder. If you close the window, you'll see on the picture on the right there, it shows a list of all the extracted files and their file names and the length of each file. Now, before you start the rip, the song titles will show up with a tick mark against all of them by default. You can unselect some of these if you only want to rip a few of the songs. And that's all it takes to turn your compact disc into MP3s. It's a fairly simple process, and the software is fairly intuitive. We're going to talk a little bit about the music tags, though. A tag is a set of information built into a digital music file, for example, an MP3 or an M4A or whatever, to give information about the file, such as the artist name, name of the song, the album name. Quite often there's a picture of the album cover or a picture of the artist. You can have the music genre. If it's a several disc set, disc 1 of 5, 2 of 5, 3 of 5, and quite a bit of other information is available. But those are the main items. The tag is read by whatever music player you're using, which can be in your computer, your smartphone, or your vehicle's infotainment system, and selected information from the tag is displayed on the screen. This tag information can also be used by some music database programs to sort and catalog the files. So you can sort by artist name, the name of the song, or the name of the album, or many other features. The tag information in any particular music file can range from nothing. Literally, if you rip the music file from a video, there's usually nothing in the tag file there. Or it can be a complete set of information. For example, if you download a file from iTunes, it's usually quite complete with album artwork and everything else. The completeness of the tag usually is a function of where the file came from. And we'll cover tags more next session and have a detailed look at them and how you can actually edit them. So if you have a music file without any tag information, you can put it in so it plays properly in your music player. Now with ExpressRip, the tag information on compact discs ranges from stuff like only track 1, track 2, track 3, to information that includes the album name, artist name, track number, and the title of each track, and the length of each track. And ExpressRIP will copy over whatever information there is on the CD. Now, ExpressRIP Power Edition, which is a slightly extra cost edition, can connect with online databases to include the tag information into the files you rip. That said, the information on these databases ranges from nothing for a CD that maybe was produced by in limited numbers by a local artist, to a complete set of tag info. And even some of the wildly popular CDs, the number 1, 2, 3 on the Billboard chart, don't necessarily have much info in these databases. So these databases are sort of a hit and miss thing. ExpressRIP, there's a free version available for personal non-commercial use, and the URL is there to download it. The free version doesn't connect to the online databases, and usually with NCH, the free version is free for forever. But the odd time they've been known to, after a while, treat it like a trial edition. Other than the free edition, you can download a free trial edition of ExpressRIP, and the trial version is good for a minimum of 30 days. And sometimes they're sloppy about it and let you go for a lot longer. Sometimes they're pretty accurate. After that trial period, you have to pay for it, or it won't work anymore. However, when you pay for it, the purchase includes all updates and upgrades for the next 6 months. Now, NCH tends to do a lot of minor upgrades and all that. So, you know, when you're 6 months in a day and they come up with an upgrade and you have to pay a bit for it, usually if the program is doing what you want it to do, I wouldn't bother. Up until I started to put this presentation together, I was using an older version of ExpressRIP that did everything I needed it to do. The current version is version 5, and like I said, there's no reason to upgrade regularly unless the version new version fixes a bug that is relevant to you. The normal price for the Power Edition is $50 US, but NCH has regular deals on the software, and the current price is $35. The Standard Edition is $35 normally. It's on sale now for $25. If you don't want to pay for it right now, once this special is over, wait till the next special. Okay, another way you can manage your CDs is to load them into iTunes. iTunes, most people think of it as a store for music, videos, movies, and other media. But iTunes can be used as a media player for your own media. So you can load all your music files into iTunes, and this includes your CDs. So to import the CD tracks into iTunes, there's a list of steps you go through there. I copy and paste this directly from iTunes, so I take no responsibility for this. I've never tried it because I don't necessarily want Apple to know what my music library consists of. Okay, so what do you do about your vinyl records and your cassettes? A lot of us have big collections of these. NCH has another piece of software called Golden Records, and you can use these to convert vinyl records and cassette tapes to digital audio. For example, you can actually burn them into a CD or turn them into an MP3 or any other format. The software can also remove hiss, clicks, pops, and other noise from old tapes or scratched records. It can normalize the volume of the recordings when converting to CD. And if you're doing an entire album, it'll automatically detect the silence between the tracks to split the audio into separate files. One of the things about a lot of good quality turntables is they use what's called Recording Industry Association of America equalization, which is a special form of equalization. And normally you have to have a special phono preamp correct this or to do the equalization for you. However, with Golden Records, you can just plug the turntable directly into the computer, and the software will do all the equalization and everything for you. Another unique feature is if you have some old 78 RPM records, I've got a very high quality turntable that I bought probably 40 years ago. It only does 45s and 33s, but with Golden Records, I can play a 78 on it, and the software will automatically correct it, the final file will come out normally. And Golden Records can also take the output of whatever you're doing and burn it onto a music CD for you. Assuming you already have a good turntable or cassette deck, you're going to need the appropriate cables and adapters to plug them into your computer. You need a lot more information on this at the Golden Records Hardware Setup Guide site, and the URL is there for it. And it gives very detailed instructions for all sorts of scenarios for plugging your equipment into your computer and what you'll need and all the rest. So it's a good source for doing this. You can also buy now turntables that have a USB output. So if you don't have a turntable, but you've inherited a bunch of vinyl records that you want to adapt, then you can get a turntable with a USB output. Now, you can also use Golden Records to recover music from any 8-tracks you have, provided you have a suitable 8-track player. But you'll find that the quality from an 8-track may not be very good, and you may be better off just downloading the song from iTunes or some other source. Next session, we're going to look at how to edit the tags and metadata for your MP3s and cover a little bit more about the naming of the music files to help in this. If you download the deck, there's a list of all the URLs that are in the deck. And by now, for your convenience, Chris has probably already pasted them into the chat window.
Yes, I have.
And that's it for today. Whoops, what have I done here?
Okay, thanks. Okay. Thanks, Bob. There was a question towards the end here. There's a lot of things in the chat, people suggesting various media players, sound editors, tag managers. So if you're interested in all that kind of stuff, a lot of free software there. Take a look in the chat window. There's all kinds of suggestions. But there was a question here from Micheline. Can Golden Records convert vinyl cassettes to MP3?
Yeah, the Golden Records, probably take the music from any analog source, which is a cassette deck, turntable or 8-track player or whatever else, and convert it into an MP3 for you. So it gives you a lot of flexibility, and like I said, it'll filter out a lot of the pops and ticks and scratches and all that vinyl records and cassettes are prone to.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Bob.
So one other point. NCH has dozens of software applications for managing audio and video, including DJ software, editing software, all sorts of stuff. So you might want to take a look at their site to see it. Another place to look if you're interested in a particular type of software is just Google, you know, best software for whatever and seeing what comes out. But you might get a dozen sites or so that come up with ratings. You want to look at a few of these. When I look at some of these ratings, I see software applications I've never heard of and aren't on any of the other sites. So some of the review sites tend to be favor particular developers more than be neutral in their ratings.
Okay, thanks, Bob. So we have a few minutes for any other questions, and a couple did come into the email while we were online, as it were. And I don't know whether I can bring this up. Let's just see what happens. If I drag that across, does that show up on the screen?
Yes, we're seeing mycra.app okay. On Android.
So this is a question from Glenn T, and he's got a Samsung Galaxy A50, and he's looking at installing the mycra mobile app, but apparently having problems getting it to run. So now he's asking, is it available on Google Play? And I don't think it is. I think it's only available by downloading from CRA directly. And he's done all these things. Can you suggest what else? So has anybody got this app actually running on a smartphone? I noticed one comment from Stuart. The A50 is nearing its end of life, so it may not be the most secure device in the world in future. So if anybody has any experience with MyCRA on a Android device, I guess we'd like to hear from you, and we'll maybe do a follow-up next week. And then there was a second question came in about display ports and HDMI. And this is, a summary of some stuff that was on the user forum. And the bottom line was down here somewhere, can anybody explain how a DisplayPort to HDMI passive cable works if you don't have a converter chip in the device that you're running? I've got no idea personally. Again, does anybody have any bright ideas on that?
Yeah, Bob Walker here. As part of my kit for when we were having live meetings, I actually got a display port to HDMI adapter. It's a nice little box with a cable coming out one end and a socket in the other end. And I have no idea how it works, if there's chips in there or whatever else. But I tested it out with my wife's Microsoft Surface computer, which has a DisplayPort outlet, and plugged it into our projector, and it works just fine. So
I have a similar sort of story, I guess. My computer has DisplayPort on it, and I plugged in an HDMI monitor. I just went down to, I think it was Canada Computers, bought, I believe it was $12 cable, and it worked. So that's all.
And ditto for me. I was surprised to hear about the need for a chip, because I've been buying a variety of different HDMI to display port cables, and I've yet to find a scenario where it doesn't work. though I did hear some of the background that is being put forward in this email, but it turned out to be like, okay, when do I run into this issue? And so far, I have not.
Okay, thanks everyone. That's some information anyway. Yeah, sounds like it's not as bad as it sounds. Okay, this is a question that just came into the chat. So if anybody is on the call that isn't familiar with what we do, at the end of the night, Chris will stop the audio recording, and that will also close the chat window. And then later on, the PowerPoint deck will be converted to a PDF file. So what you've seen in terms of PowerPoint slides tonight will be in a PDF file. The audio recording and the contents of the chat window as a text file will all get uploaded to OPCUG's website. So if you go to opcu.ca, opcug.ca/QA, that will get you the ability to download all of the information from tonight and also all the archives of our past sessions. And Chris, I guess we should just mention that we believe that tonight is
the 100th Q&A since we went to Zoom Q&A meetings. We've had Q&A after monthly meetings for many, many years, but when we went to Zoom, we started doing it weekly. And so if we did our math correctly or arithmetic correctly, tonight is the 100th. At next week's Q&A or possibly the Q&A after that, I will have the stats in terms of the number of attendees we've had, the number of topics we've covered over those 100 sessions. And I'll also have a short article for the August newsletter, which will be the next newsletter we have up. So, and in that vein, we did have a question about early on in chatting before the meeting that we only had two more Q&A sessions. No. As long as there is continued interest, we are going to continue to run Q&A throughout the summer and onward, as we have done for the last two summers. So there will be no break in Q&As other than the regular meeting nights when we don't have Q&A sessions. And so we hope that people will continue to join us and continue to send in shares and questions and answers and all the rest of it throughout the summer.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So to kind of echo some of those thoughts, we won't have any regular monthly meetings now until September. And as you probably remember, September 14th is going to be our first meeting in the fall, and it's going to be a members' favorites. And so what we're looking for is your input on any computer-related topic. If you have an application, a program that you absolutely love, you'd like to share with everyone. If you bought some hardware that's just fantastic, we'd like to hear about it. And if you know how to fix things in operating systems, then we like to hear about those kind of things too. And we suggest like 10 or 20 minute presentations, but if you want to be shorter or longer, we can probably accommodate that too. So you've got lots of time between now and September the 14th. Put your presentation together, send us a note on what you want to present, and we will organize the agenda appropriately. However, before September, on July the 4th, we have the final session in our OPCUG Tech Talks, and this is going to be our friend Chris, who's going to be talking about wireless security. So if you need to find out how to make your router absolutely secure, or at least as secure as humanly possible, Chris will be there to tell you how. You do need to register for this because we are charging non-members, but if you're a member of the club, it's free for members. Just send us a note, and we will add you to the list. And then finally, our next Q&A, depending if you all send in your questions and shares and and things for next week. And we'll have a whole bunch of material, no doubt. So send us your questions and your topics. And next week, June the 22nd, which will be next Wednesday, regular 7:30, we'll see you all there. So thanks for attending the 100th Q&A, and we look forward to the next 100, I guess. That's it for me.
Thanks for coming out, folks. We'll see you next week.